Okay, well, thank you, David. So when I am here for 3 weeks visiting the people across the street, the Station Q group, to cultivate my topological side, so to speak, because the other half of the time I do high TC where there is little topology, so far as anyone can tell. So here I'm thinking about entanglement and topological phases and things like that. And I came to say hello to David, and when I left his office, I made a commitment to give a talk. So he later told me what the composition of the audience was, and decided, well, I have to do something to make this understandable, at least for the first 15 minutes. It's a sort of a multicultural talk, and we'll see how it goes. I wish I was more alert. I normally like to drink espresso. Here they have a fabulous espresso, but the person in charge there in the front office didn't recognize me as being authorized. So I have a complaint about that. So maybe this can be corrected in the future. And so I am an espresso star at the moment, so maybe I can use as an excuse. All right, so we'll talk about, the title of the talk is Can You Hear the Shape of Schrödinger's Cat? Now, that kind of title, you can pretty much talk about anything you please, as you can imagine. So the original title, of course, was a lot longer, and when David decided that he wanted to shorten the title, it reminded me of this movie Amadeus, where Mozart presents, I think, a symphony to the emperor, and he says that there are too many notes. So this is a compressed version here. Sorry, don't take that personally, but then I need to... The longer version of the title was more technical and probably would have scared a lot of people. So this is a good way to attract people by not telling them really what the talk is about. So let me give you an outline. So to some extent, this is an overview of a field. From a personal point of view, more than my own work alone, it's more of a collective creation, if you wish. Even my own work for the past 10 years or so in this area involves a lot of people. So, aside from me, I will want to know people like Claude Moore, Berkeley. From Virginia, my colleague Bob Lee, from Havana, who's a string theorist, and his students, Xing Dong, and Sean Nolan. This is actually perhaps the more technical part, and I will only give a couple of results without explaining too much where it comes from. That will really make it very technical if I go through all that. And as well as work that I've done with students and postdocs, particularly Stefanos Papanicolaou. He's a student, he's finishing now, and Kumar Raman, former postdoc. And some of the part of the historical part of the talk involves all the work that involves people like Fendley and Eddie Adon, who some people here know, as well as Shivaji Sondhi. And Roderick Mosman. And many others. Now there are other, many of these ideas were also elaborated by many other people. I will, as much as I can, try to be accurate. The other option is to have a reference-free talk, and everybody gets upset. But I'll try to give references whenever necessary. So the outline is the following. I will talk about topological spaces in communication. The connection between that and the notion of quantum criticality. Okay. And in particular, the notion of using the concept of quantum entanglement. And scaling behavior as a way to characterize critical point, quantum critical points and topological phases. So we will go and describe what these things mean for the moment. And then we'll end with some applications. Notably to the only non-topological phase in condensed matter, which is the fractional quantum for liquid. And I will explain a little bit what that liquid is. So what's the motivation? So the motivation for doing all of this, in particular for introducing the concept of entanglement, which I will describe in detail in a moment, is that it's a good measurement, it's a good measure of the degree of correlations in a quantum system. It's usually a very non-local property, okay? And probably the best example of that, and maybe that's how I should begin.
Yes? For the benefit of the older members of the audience, like, yes. Can you speak up and write bigger, please?
Okay. Right. Okay, I can do that. Maybe I can click something here and it will, you know, go to a different point. Okay, I'll do that. Okay. I thought there was already a question, but... All right, so we'll talk about why quantum entanglement is interesting here. And this is a concept that actually has come up in theoretical physics over the years very many times. It has been regarded a bit as a, to some extent, as a curiosity and for some as a nuisance. If you work, for example, the quantum information people is a major tool, but if you want to think in terms of extended systems, mainly it's either in condensed matter or in field theory, it's an incredibly non-local quantity that is extremely difficult to think that anyone will ever measure. However, there is some possibility, actually, that some aspects of this could be accessed by experiment. I'll discuss some of that at the end. And this part is largely speculative and it could well be wrong. But at the moment, we don't have a real good way to measure this directly in a macroscopic system. Okay? Okay, yes. So we'll explain. So let me begin with a simple example of what entanglement is and how this we're going to extend these ideas to other things. So we're going to begin with a very simple system and before we get into things which are a little more complicated. So the simplest system, so in entanglement what you want to do is imagine you have a system with a big system with a lot of degrees of freedom, and I want to observe only a smaller part of the system, which I'm going to call B. Okay, A union B is the entire universe of your system, and you imagine that the whole thing is in some state, in some quantum state, and you don't want to, or you can't, observe the full system, but you observe only some subset. Okay, and obviously the wave function of this system knows not only about the degrees of freedom that are sitting here and the degrees of freedom that are sitting there, but how they talk to each other, how they are correlated to each other. And therefore, this is actually a rather complicated correlated expression. Things of this type have been discussed in a variety of areas of people interested in black holes. For instance, I think about this as well, where, in a sense, this is the event horizon and the question is whether you can infer some information which is on the other side of the event horizon if you have a full coherent wave function. We're not going to do black holes here, but some of the formulas actually that actually show up here for other reasons showed up in a similar, in that setting as well. And simply because I suppose there is a law of conservation of good ideas, and if they are good in some area, eventually they show up in some other area as well. So usually for a good reason. Okay. All right, so let me begin with a simple problem. Imagine that my two systems are two spins. We have an object that can have spin up or spin down. Here, let me call that site 1 and site 2. And you may have spins pointing in some direction. And as you probably recall from your undergraduate days, if you want to write down an expression, say for example in a molecule, when you have two electrons, usually the lowest energy state, you put that in some sort of what is called a singlet or anti-symmetric state. So you can have a state where site 1 is spinned up, site 2 is spinned down, and the other one does the opposite combination, and you get a wave function. So this wave function has, if you look at the probability of this guy alone, the probability of finding the spin up is actually 1/2. And it's also the same probability of finding it to be spin down in this particular case. Nevertheless, these two states are actually talking to each other. So if you say, well, now this is my wave function, so let's say psi, there is a quantity that is often introduced. It's called the density matrix. And what the density matrix is, it's a quantity that for a, in this example, this is what is called a pure state. It's perfectly coherent. So you not, in, so in a sense, you have complete information of both system 1 and system 2, what both are doing in this case, because it's defined by a unique state. Okay?
Is very it often, spin 1/2 or not?
Yes, spin 1/2. Yeah. That's why they are up and down. Yeah, this is a singlet state. This is total spin 0 is equal to 0. And this is a spin thing. Okay. So this is actually a very simple state. And in fact, quite early on in quantum mechanics, states like this attracted a bit of attention because no one is telling us how far these two guys are from each other. And if I do something to observe this spin, in particular to determine what its spin polarization is, it clearly affects what the other spin is doing, even though the other spin may be very far away. And so there are all these statements in the history of quantum mechanics, such as where is the moon there where nobody looks, and things of that sort. And if I flip a spin here and the other partner is in the moon, can you tell that I flipped the spin in this side? So if you have a perfect coherence, in other words, coherence over macroscopic distances, in principle that will happen. As you know, for macroscopic systems such as you and me, that's kind of difficult. There is usually thermodynamic backgrounds, there are fluctuations due to the heat paths and so on, and you lose coherence rather rapidly for most cases. So in practice, this is not possible. Where this crossover from the coherent to the incoherent behavior happens is a complicated problem that I will not address today. Okay, that's a homework problem, if you will. Okay. So, for those of you that spend most of your time doing things in a situation where the system is essentially incoherent, that's what happens in classical systems for the most part, then much of what I'm going to talk about here is rather arcane and strange. Okay. The reason for me to address this problem in this case is because there are a number of phases of matter that I will describe to you in a little bit, which even though they contain a large number of electrons, say 10 to 11 electrons or something like that, which is certainly not a system with a few degrees of freedom, has a large number of them. It's 10 to the 11th because they are confined to be in a plane and not 10 to the 23 as they would be if they were in three-dimensional space. And so even so, that system has a large number of degrees of freedom. The samples are millimeters in size, so you can do experiments on them with macroscopic units, essentially. So you don't need to go down to the atomic scale or the subatomic scale to investigate these properties. And yet, many of these spooky properties of quantum mechanics are actually rather inherent in the behavior of such systems. And that's the interest of it. That's why this fractional quantum Hall states are interesting in many, may be interesting for many other reasons, but one of the reasons that make them interesting is because they have these topological aspects of quantum mechanics are manifest at the macroscopic level. They can be accessed in experiments that I will discuss a couple of experiments later, where some of these properties are actually tested. Okay, so in principle, if you want to do experiments in fractional quantum Hall systems, experiments that are actually being done now, they can actually access some of these issues, in particular the question of whether or not you can you can actually look at the entanglement of two different regions and so on. So we'll talk about that as we go on. All right? So, but one of the aspects of this problem is the inherent non-locality of this. If I try to probe this with some, say, some operator that measures some local property, then this will be extremely difficult. I will have to do that, in a sense, all over the boundary, if you wish, of this region here. And if this region gets very big, I will have to make a large number of experiments, in principle. And that's the reason why most of us tended to believe that this quantity was uninteresting in extended systems. And it's the topological nature of the state, as you will see, that makes some of these ideas relevant or accessible. Okay, so in that sense, one needs that. Yes.
I just wanted to ask a question about an extended system. If quantum coherence was important for the functioning of the brain,
yes,
how would we know?
Well, I think we are getting into Gödelian physics. I don't know if the brain can ask itself that question. That's my best answer to that question. Yes.
There are people who argue that because the brain can do things that are beyond the Turing machine, well, it's not the argument. They can't be described by quantum mechanics. But some very famous mathematician, I don't call him.
All right, so let me, so having said this, so in this particular case, this entanglement entropy is measured in terms of this property. I'm not sure whether to write down the expression of the density matrix, but there is a matrix called the density matrix that if you have, say, suppose you have a wave function for the degrees of freedom, let's say in A, let me call them phi A, and the degrees of freedom in B, phi B, the full wave function depends on both. And the density matrix will be a matrix that will depend on the degrees of freedom on both sides. Let me put some primes here. And this is just nothing but the product of the wave function, or the joint wave function, and the complex conjugate for the other set of configurations. So for a pure system, the density matrix is just obtained by simple multiplication. Many of you have seen other density matrices. In particular, if you do statistical mechanics, there is the Gibbs density matrix that tells you what is the probability for an ensemble in thermal equilibrium, and the density matrix in that case is 1 over the partition function e to the minus the Hamiltonian divided by kt. Okay. And in that case, at least in the eigenstate basis, is the density matrix is diagonal, and that system, in some sense, is maximally mixed, as it is called. So things like this are usually called mixed states. When the density matrix has a simple form, it's called a density matrix of a pure state. So nevertheless, many years ago, John von Neumann introduced the notion of entanglement entropy. Yes. Essentially by analogy with the statistical and mechanical entropy, to be minus the trace of rho log rho, where rho here corresponds to the reduced density matrix obtained by tracing over the degrees of freedom that I'm not going to look at. So it will be the effective density matrix of this part of the system. And if you were in a situation like that, if you go to a basis of eigenstates, this would be the sum over the states, say, labeled by some label lambda. This actually becomes the probability of that times the log of the probability of that state. Okay. So if one knows for a given system what the set of probabilities is, in principle you can compute the entanglement entropy. But to compute that from a complicated wave function for a rather extended system is actually a difficult problem. Okay. So when this entropy is essentially, so as you can see here, so if the, for instance, if the states are such that if instead of looking at the subset of states, I look at the entire state, then there will be only one state that is allowed, the other ones will have probability zero, and then you're going to get that the entropy is a zero. In that case. In this particular case, if you go through the calculation of that and you ask what is the entropy, the entanglement entropy of spin number one, without observing spin number two, you observe instead that this quantity is just the log of two, which is the intuitive notion that there are two states there that are equally probable, and therefore you'll expect to see the log of the number of possible states will be two. In that sense, it agrees with the intuitive notion of entropy that comes from statistical mechanics in that limit. All right, so this is an interesting expression, but as I said, in general, it's very difficult to do computations with this type of quantity. So the question that we are interested in is how does this quantity behave in extended systems, particular systems which are either close to what I'm going to call a quantum critical point, I will explain to you in a moment what it is, or in particular in one of these topological phases. So I will change the order now. We'll first discuss quantum criticality, and then I will go to what happens in the topological case. So let me erase this part. So what's the system at quantum criticality? Well, since it is critical, it has to be macroscopic in size. So it's a thermodynamic system at zero temperature. So we're going to be interested in systems which are in the thermodynamic limit. In other words, the systems are very large. The number of degrees of freedom essentially goes infinity. The temperature is going to be zero. And I'm going to imagine that as a function of some parameter or coupling constant, I can take the system from one type of behavior or phase to another type of behavior or phase. So the simplest system that does that is an Ising model, not surprisingly. Okay, but this is not going to be talked about Ising models, but this is sort of a simple example where a quantum critical point can be. Imagine that I have a chain, as an example, a bunch of sites. I have spins that live on these sites, and I have a Hamiltonian that, as a function of the sites, has a term here that likes to have nearby spins to line up because it can reduce the energy by having them to be lined up. And I'm going to have a term that will play the role of the kinetic energy, that this term is not diagonal in the basis of sigma z, it's off diagonal. Remember, sigma z is that, and sigma x is off diagonal. So this term comes and flips the spins. So as a function of the parameter g, when g is small, all of the spins like to line up and they like to be magnetized in that sense. So there is a local order parameter, which is a local magnetization, and the system is being polarized. On the other hand, if g is very large, this term can be neglected, and then you essentially have to minimize the eigenvalue of these guys, and they are all, there is a unique ground state, and they have no polarization. So as a function of the polarization, or the magnetization, if you want to call it, G, the magnetization usually does something like that, and there is a critical value where this actually goes to zero. Now, you probably know the thermal version of this, which is the usual Ising law that is studied in classical statistical mechanics. In other words, essentially what you're looking at is a classical phase transition as a function of temperature, instead of a function of coupling constant, as I'm doing here. And most quantum phase transitions look very much like classical phase transitions. And there is a reason for that, and this is one of the issues I want to address. So let me tell you what is the quantum aspect of this, and in what sense where quantum mechanics matters and where it doesn't. Let me finish this and I'll come to you. So the spins here may or may be, as you approach this critical value, there is a correlation function that becomes long range. It goes essentially in this side, say it's exponentially decaying, and then when you arrive to this critical point, it becomes a power law. So there is a correlation length that the function of the coupling constant diverges with some critical exponent nu. And on the other hand, there is an energy gap, so this is the correlation length. There is an energy gap. Call it delta. That as a function of the coupling goes to zero as you arrive at that point. So the system has an energy gap in this case on both sides of the phase transition. In other words, the difference between the ground state energy and the first excited state becomes smaller and smaller and goes to zero as you arrive to that, you reach that point. And that typically goes like G minus GC times another exponent Z times the same exponent nu. This exponent usually is called the dynamic dynamical, this critical exponent. For this particular system, which is the IC model, Z happens to be 1. And that means that essentially the energy, which is a gap, scales like the inverse of a length. And that's like what happens in a relativistic system. So for that reason, all of these quantum critical systems that have Z equals 1 close enough to that phase transition, they behave like relativistic field theory. Okay. In that sense. But that's a side, it's a side question. There are many examples, and we're going to see one today, where Z is not equal to 1. In fact, we're going to have an example where Z is 2. That is of it's actually quite a simple system. You can actually make a number of statements for that. But there are many examples, particularly, of course, in high energy physics, everything has to have Z equals 1 by relativity. But in condensed matter, one, whether it's a benefit or a problem, one has smaller options and one has to consider things which have this character. Yes, you had a question for.
What you call magnetization is the Z component of.
Yes, it's the Z component.
Because, but G is larger than X component.
Yeah, I chose not to call that magnetization. So the point, and there is a reason for that. This system has a symmetry, which involves, by acting with these operators simultaneously, everywhere you can flip all the spins at the same time. The magnetization is all under that operation, and this ground state breaks that symmetry spontaneously. So in that sense, there is what is called, we call a local order parameter in this case, okay, which is precisely the expectation value of the sigma z of the z polarization of the spin. For a system which is fully rotationally variant, it doesn't matter if I choose that. This is not rotationally variant. All right, so there is, in this theory, there is a local order parameter. All of these excitations are related to states that you create with operators that act locally. And the only thing you need to know in practice is what is the correlation length, how does it behave, and how does it scale, what is the scaling between energy and length, which is what is scaling. Okay. Now, as you can see, this is actually very similar to what happens in a classical critical system. The only thing I had to do is to choose here this value of Z, and there are in fact classical systems that have an isotropic scaling between, the, say, in-plane and out-of-plane and things like that. In liquid crystals, this is well-known, for instance. There are systems that behave actually much like this system does with Z equals 2. The one I'm going to refer to actually has a close relative in the theory of liquid crystals. They don't need that. They don't have ABS tools. I'll come to that in a moment, though. All right, so this is what usually is called a quantum critical system. Now, you would say there is little else that you learn by going quantum that you didn't know when you were classical, apart from the fact that these are systems that are realized in experiment that you have to figure out what the experiment is saying. So the question is, where is quantum mechanics in this? Well, quantum mechanics in some sense is in the exponent z. And aside from that, and if there is actually little new in going to quantum phase transitions that you didn't know from classical ones. Now, if you do this, you know, nature is more interesting than this. So if you have two parameters, say g and temperature, now you can have various sort of crossovers, and you can discuss how things scale at finite but low temperature, whether you can actually see this quantum critical behavior. So for instance, here you're going to see a line of transitions, and these are classical ones, and here there is a quantum transition. But typically there is a thing here where you see what is called the quantum critical regime, and this is actually accessible to a number of experiments. So you can access, even though this happens at zero temperature, if you are lucky, this region can be sufficiently broad that, say, light scattering experiments or neutron scattering can actually access the behavior at zero temperature. So this is all due to the physics of local operators, and in that sense, you don't learn about criticality in this quantum problem, anything that you truly didn't know in the classical case. So then you ask yourself, is there a quantity in this type of system that actually is more characteristic of quantum mechanics aside from the behavior of these local operators such as the magnetization and so on, or the energy density? And the natural candidate is the entanglement entropy. Okay? And then the question that is natural to ask is, how does the entanglement entropy behave in the vicinity of one of these quantum critical points? That doesn't have a classical analog. Okay? That's inherently a quantum mechanical property, and so that's a quantity of interest in that sense. Now, people think that this actually tells you something about the degree of complexity of being able to calculate that. Say, suppose you do some simulation, so how long do you have to run a computer code to actually determine the critical behavior of the system? Will actually, of course, if the wave function was very simple, was a product, and the states did not talk, the subsystems don't talk to each other, in other words, you don't ever get to the critical point, in that case, there is no complexity in the calculation, and the entropy in some sense is trivial. There is nothing of interest to do there. But what you want to do is to understand how does this entanglement entropy behave as you reach this critical point. Okay, so that's one line of thought for why this is of interest. Okay. So let me discuss a little bit of that. And I'm going to discuss some results in one dimension. So capital D is the dimensionality of space in this case. So D is one. It turns out that one-dimensional systems that are critical are very simple, and they have to obey a large number of constraints that I'm not going to discuss today. This was found by trial and error over the years, but eventually it became summarized in a construction that actually originated in string theory. It's called conformal field theory. It turns out in one dimension, all of these quantum critical points are representations of some conformal field theory, can be described in terms of that. And you can use such methods to compute the entanglement entropy. You can also do that directly by brute force computation on different systems. So people have done it in particular for this one and many others. But there is a general rule that these things obey. So let me first tell you some universal properties that quantum critical systems obey in 1D. So what are the quantities that you normally would think about in a system that is quantum mechanical? Well, you want to know what the ground state energy does. And how does the ground state energy behave, for instance, at this point? So let's say we call that quantity E. So if I divide this by the length of the system, so you have a system which is now, L here is now going to be the total length. In a moment, it's going to be something else. And you find that the energy per unit length is going to be, if you go to the thermodynamic limit, this has to reach a limit, which is the energy density of the system. It's usually not a very interesting quantity. It does have some singularities as a function of G, but it's not a particularly interesting one. This quantity, in some sense, is the analog of the free energy of the classical problem, in some ways. There is a finite size correction to this, like what is usually called the Casimir term in the energy, Casimir effect, and it goes like this. So it's a 1 over L correction to that. to this term. There's a finite size correction. It has this funny pi over 6 that people like, so I'm going to keep it here. V here is the velocity of these excitations, of these for instance, the excitations of this type, how fast they move. There's a number that obviously is not universal, and that depends on your choice of microscopic length, but that choice essentially gets cancelled from here. But there is this quantity here that is known as the central charge in the conformal field theory. This quantity is actually a universal quantity. And this quantity enters in this particular form in the computation of the ground state energy. So in other words, it tells you that if you compare an infinite system with a finite one, the energy will go up by some amount that goes like 1 over L, and there is this prefactor that is actually universal. Now, there is a related calculation that you can do. Now you can take the infinite system and compute the heat capacity per unit length, in other words, the specific heat. And you find that this quantity is proportional to the temperature, and it has a prefactor, it's very similar, it's pi over 6, again, C over the same velocity. So if you measure the heat capacity, or the specific heat of this chain, as a function of temperature, again, it will obey a similar law, and the same central charge appears in both places. So for the Ising mode, that number is 1/2, for instance. For an XY mode, that number is 1. And so on. So this is something that people have studied in great detail. Now, more recently, people decided to calculate, and they did that, as I said, partly brute force and partly on general grounds, what the entanglement entropy would be in a system like this. And I'm going to take an infinite system, and I'm going to imagine that I'm going to observe a side system of size L. Let me call R the size of the big system. I want to be in a regime where the size of the system, the thermodynamic size, is much bigger than the size of the region that I'm going to observe, which is going to be large compared to, say, the lattice spacing of my system. So I want to be in a macroscopic regime, some sort of hydrodynamic regime. There is a beautiful result that I will not derive that shows that the von Neumann entropy, the quantity we discussed before, yes?
Up over the C over L.
Yes?
There's no L, it's really V over L, CT over K over L.
Here, there is no L.
Was there no L there?
But this is the heat capacity per unit length. Otherwise, there will be an L here. This is a specific, it's the heat capacity per unit length of chain. So this is proportional to T. And this one goes like 1 over L. You see, again, the reason is because Z is 1. So an energy, which is temperature, scales like the inverse of a length. There are some velocities you have to be careful about here. Yes?
How come there is no singularity at the transition point in this C?
C is a universal number which is defined only at the transition point. The heat capacity, you're at zero temperature at criticality. So this is only true at the critical point. Okay, otherwise, suppose it was a gap, you would have expected an exponentially small heat capacity. Would be e to the minus a gap divided by t. Because you're at criticality, there is no gap. Precisely, the theory, the system is gapless. So you need something which is going to be scaling invariant. And because z is 1, the only thing you can do is to be linear in t. Okay? So you have the question is, what is the entanglement entropy of a system like that when you take a very large subsystem, but it's small compared to the total size of the system, but large compared to the microscopic scale. And there is a very nice result that was originally was derived case by case, but eventually there was a nice general result that was derived from conformal field theory. And it's again the central charge divided by 3 times the log of the size of the system in dimensionless units up to finite terms. Okay? So this quantity, the entanglement entropy, grows logarithmically as a function of the size of the system. And the prefactor, in this case, is a universal number. It's the same number that appears everywhere here. divided by 3. So in the case of, say, the Ising model that I discussed, this number would have been 1/6. And this is done, you know, people did that numerically first. This result was actually derived for other reasons by back in the 90s by Callan and Harvey, Wilczek. I was discussing a paper by Callan and Harvey before, that's why I got confused. And this had to do, actually, the motivation for these earlier papers in the 90s in string theory. This is a paper from string theory, well, presumably, I'm not sure, was related to the problem of understanding the black hole entropy and the so-called area law in black hole entropy. So let me mention that in a moment. If one tries to generalize this result to higher dimensions, so what one will be interested in is to say, suppose I have some generic quantum critical point in any dimension, is there a universal part of this entanglement entropy and how does it behave? Or in general, what is the expected behavior? Now, in general dimension, something else, even if you're not at a critical point, so suppose that I observe some region, A, A with size, will be L will be the size of this region. Well, your system may have some nice simple properties at very long distances, but still the wave function will know about all the junk that happens at short distances. Okay, we'll have actually detailed knowledge of that. And actually was shown quite early on by Mark Schrotnicki, who's the physics department chair here, I think, still here?
Yeah.
Okay. In 93, I think. So he studied the massive scalar field from region A. He was trying to understand the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy problem. And he found that, in fact, there was some sort of, quote, area law. So in this case, it will go in general dimension, like L to the D minus 1. And it's called an area because it doesn't depend on the volume, but only on the surface area of that region. You notice that if D goes to 1, this is L to the 0, and that's where the logarithm comes from. But in general dimension, the prefactor here is not universal. Because this actually scales, this actually will depend on the microscopic landscape, on the cutoff, if you wish. We will know about the short distance detail. So this is not in general, so this is actually true, not at the critical point, this is in some massive phase. And in fact, the fact that this actually depended on ultraviolet physics was what I think made Mark believe that this had nothing to do with the Bekenstein entropy formula. Because there you will need to know something about the Planck length or something like that. But so if you do this for a generic quantum mechanical system at the quantum critical point, this term will be present. The question is there a subdominant term, some universal piece of this, that this formula doesn't capture? It has to be some correction. So this actually brings me to study. Okay, so in general, the answer to this is we don't know. Okay, the general behavior of this quantity at generic quantum critical points is not a quantity problem that is understood. I'm going to show you what happens in a particular class of distance in two space dimensions, d equals 2, which are not relativistic, so z is 2, in particular in my case. And there, actually, you can actually write down the wave function, you can compute this directly by explicit calculation, and you find actually something interesting which relates to the title of this talk. But the general behavior is still an open problem, and if anybody has good ideas about it, it's a difficult calculation. I mean, it's not particular. So if you're in generic dimension, you cannot do this with free fields. You have to go to the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. It's more complicated. Okay. So let me now. There is another set of problems that, and this actually has to do with the properties at the topological phase. And so let me switch gears and talk about some simple two-dimensional systems that are critical, why they are interesting, and how they are related to topology. So let me first begin with the topological phase. So what do we mean by a topological phase? And this actually is a good thing to compare with this type of state, This is a state here, for instance, we found that the ground state breaks the symmetry spontaneously, so it's magnetized and it's not magnetized on the other side. So it's characterized by the expectation value of the local magnetization that is not zero. Okay, so there is some local operator that when it's not, the expectation value is not zero, this operator is an operator under some symmetry, in this case, the up-down symmetry of the spins. In that particular case, we can say the system is in some particular phase, it's in a magnetic state. Okay? So that's normally how we understand phases of matter, is by looking at how other parameters behave. Okay? That's, we learned that from Landau and before Landau, Curie, I suppose. Right? So a topological phase is, however, a phase that doesn't break any symmetry. They say, well, okay, that's a liquid. Well, most liquids are not all that interesting. They may be interesting for many other purposes, but not from this point of view. So how do we know if we have a liquid with some interesting properties? So we want to have a liquid phase, so it's a phase with no broken symmetries. And what I mean to say, no spontaneously broken symmetries. You can break some symmetries explicitly, like time reversal, and we're going to see an example now. So in particular, they are translation invariant, rotation invariant. They don't do anything. They look particularly inert from that point of view. But the ground state has degeneracies that depend on the topology of the surface, and this I'm going to think of two-dimensional systems, or the surface on which you sit. So in the plane, on the disk, usually the ground state is unique. If you were able to do an experiment in a sphere, it would also be unique. But if you do that with periodic boundary conditions, so you go to a torus, then you find that there is a four-fold degeneracy in that case. And so these degeneracies don't originate from the breaking of some symmetry, which is a more standard situation. So these systems have ground state degeneracies that are due essentially to the topology of the surface on which the system is sitting. So the best example of this, and the one that is the only one that is understood in the sense for which we can do experiments on, are the fractional contour body liquids. What time is it? Oh, okay, so I have about 10 minutes or so. Okay. So what is this? So this is a system where inside the semiconductor, by magic that people like Loren Pfeiffer at AT&T or whatever it's called now know how to do, they can confine the electrons to live in the surface within, say, a few angstroms of some region. The surface, the electrons move almost freely on that surface. In the most recent samples, the mean free path is about a tenth of a millimeter, so you can see it with your eyes. And the samples are 5 millimeters across, so it was half a millimeter, the best one. So there are essentially 10 elastic scatterings from one edge of the sample to the other. So this is a set of billiards, if you want. Okay, it's extremely pure. It's very hard to manipulate a system that is that clean, as it turns out, because it doesn't have the robustness that some amount of dirt actually endows the system with. So it turns out that that's actually both a plus and a problem for the experiment. So now the magnetic field goes this way. The electrons live on this, quote, plane, and they are confined to be in some region. Okay, so they form a liquid drop. There is some potential that essentially due to the shape of the sample that confines the electrons to that regime. There is a magnetic field. And in particular, all these states have a finite energy gap. And that means that you cannot, if you want to create some local excitation here, you have to spend some amount of energy. And the only low energy excitation you can actually make is by going to the edge of the system and take your liquid drop and do something like that. So you make some wave, if you wish, along the boundary. Thus, as you make the wavelength longer and longer, the energy will go down. So it's a very low energy state. Because this is a charged fluid and it's in a magnetic field, there is an electric field that is confining the electrons this way, and there is a magnetic field going that way. And we learned in kindergarten that if you have charged particles in cross electric and magnetic fields, they move with a drift velocity in the perpendicular direction. So the only thing they can do is they have to essentially precess, if you wish, along that direction. So this is an example where you have effectively a one-dimensional system, which is this edge state. And the excitations can only move in a direction determined by the sign, the direction of the perpendicular magnetic field. You cannot propagate backwards in this case, so it's chiral. Okay. You can make excitations, which are essentially vortices of this fluid. They cost energy. And that means, because there is a vortex here, some amount of charge will have to be expelled by the change in the angular momentum. And if it is expelled from there, it has to show up at the boundary. And a theory of this was formulated quite early on by Bob Laughlin. I think the paper is from 83, and he was awarded the Nobel Prize for this theory together with the experimentalists Stormer and Tsui, who discovered the fractional quantum Hall effect. So for the particular case where the number of electrons in the plane divided by the number of flux quanta. The number of flux quanta is essentially the total magnetic flux divided by the area. Okay, it's the number of flux quanta. So this number is called the filling fraction. And in this particular case, let me say it's one-third. This is the case that Laughlin studied. This is the most studied of these fractional quantum Hall states. But Laughlin showed that if you define a complex number, which will be the x coordinate of an electron and the y coordinate of the electron, the component of the coordinate of the electron, the wave function for n such coordinates, for n particles, so n will be this number, is actually given with excellent approximation by the following expression that is known as the Laughlin wave function. For the one-third state, the number is cubed. And exponential factor like that. And this length scale there is what is called a magnetic length. It doesn't really matter here. So it's a rather peculiar wave function. It turns out to be an excellent wave function because if you put electrons with a Coulomb interaction and so on and project into the Landau level, this wave function has a 99% overlap with the exact ground state obtained by exact diagonalization. And if you ask how you make a hole, in other words, how you make one of these vortices, what you want to do is to precisely to change locally the amount of angular momentum. And what he proposed is that the wave function, including a hole, there, with something like that, times this expression here. So it turns out that the charge that this thing obtains, that this thing has, is actually not an integer. It's fractional. So the charge turns out to be E over 3. And in fact, for most of the quantum Hall states that are observed in this experiment, there are lots of them, typically is the charge of the electron divided by the denominator of the fraction. But these excitations have another weird property, which is known as fractional statistics. And the simple way to imagine that is imagine that the picture, imagine you have two vortices, two, say, coordinates x vector and y vector. And I want to find, to take a wave function for these two particles, these two defects. And as a function of time, I can imagine an adiabatic process where I want to exchange these two particles. So what you want to do is the function of time, this one will go this way until they exchange places. For those of you with an interest in topology in the audience, it's called the braiding. So the idea is that these particles don't cross over each other. It's a strong core interaction that don't allow them to do it. But you end up with the same configuration except that they exchange. Now, as we know, in nature, there are two types of particles, fermions and bosons. Fermions change sign. Why, when you do an exchange, That's why there is an exclusion principle, and that's why atoms are stable. Bosons, on the other hand, are symmetric under this process, and that's why bosons can condense. Well, these things do something in between. So you end up with something that, when you exchange these two coordinates by that, you end up with a phase factor here. And the phase factor happens to be pi divided by 3. So these things are called anions. They are in between fermions and bosons. And it's an example of what is known as fractional statistics. So this is the states when people do calculations with them. Say if you, instead of working in a finite system, you now put this on a torus, if you wish, experimentally it's kind of hard, but when you do calculations you can. And there you find that there is a degeneracy in the ground state, and in this particular case the degeneracy is 3. But if you do this on a disk or in a sphere, it's non-degenerate. So this is actually the only topological fluid that we really have access in experiments, and these are the experiments where they do this. So what we know about these systems, and this is actually from work that was done 10 years ago, but some variant of that we mentioned now was done actually quite recently for a different state. So Heidblum and his group at the Weizmann Institute, and Christian Glatley and his group in, well, he was in Saclay when he did the experiment, and he's now at the Conormal. They did essentially the same experiment. They took a quantum Hall fluid. We're looking at it from top down. They put, so here's fluid. They put an electrostatic gate top that will tend to depress the amount of electrons there. So what happens is that the edge states, so to speak, come in because the fluid is incompressible. So this creates essentially a constriction in that channel. And from work that was done by, well, Wen and Matthew Fisher and Charlie Kane and a number of others, we know that in this case there will be a tunneling current connecting these two edges. And what will tunnel there will be the most relevant, essentially triggered by the most relevant perturbation, is the lightest excitation you can have, happens to be this beast. Happens to be that guy. So by measuring the noise in the tunneling current, these experimentalists measure the charge. Okay, so measure the noise, which they call S, but I'm not going to call S just to avoid confusion. There is a formula that in the low tunneling limit, this formula is twice the effective charge, I think I call it Q here, times the tunneling current that you will get there. So it's in the low current limit, the noise is proportional to the current, and you can use that to determine the charge. So this was done in 1997 or thereabouts, and that's actually what motivated, I think, the Nobel Committee to award the prize, because in a sense this was taken to be the actual discovery of a particle with fractional charge. Okay. To measure fractional statistics, you need to do statistics, it's like tango, right? You need two. Okay? So you need to do a double point contact here. So imagine that you now put two of these things. Another will be a direct and exchange process that involves essentially crossing here between these things. And this, in a sense, is an interferometer in this type of device. And these ideas were proposed in 97 for the Abelian case, was discussed by Claudio Chamon and a large number of co-authors. There were about six in that paper. And they showed how it worked. It had some difficulties because you need to control how much flux there is here. This experiment, there has been an attempt by Vladimir Goldman to do this. It turns out that it has a number of difficulties at the moment, and the answers are not completely clear experimentally. But these experiments will be repeated now for reasons that have to do with the next one. Now, there is actually a more complicated version, if you wish, of this, which is more interesting. The so-called non-abelian quantum Hall state. in a moment why is it called an abelian. So there is a state at ceiling factor phi house that has been mysterious for, has been known since the late 80s to exist. And it violates this rule that all of these states have an even, have to have an odd denominator. This is the only one that was known to have an even denominator. So any variant of Laughlin's ideas actually doesn't quite work for that. In 91, there was a paper by Greg Moore and Nick Reed that proposed a generalization of this Laughlin state that explained that. A little more complicated. I need to write it for so we'll there's a factor here called the Pfaffian. And then a factor here that looks more or less like the Laughlin state. So this is even, the usual exponential factor is here. So this part is even under exchange, this part is odd. The Pfaffian is the following expression. So you take these particles and you pair them up and write an expression like this in all possible ways, and then you anti-symmetrize the whole thing. So it's a fully anti-symmetric state. Looks like it has a pole, which would be bad news in general, but because this has a power of 2, there's no singularity, it's a perfectly regular wave function without any problem. In this case, something unusual happens. Well, not only is a good candidate, in fact, is the best candidate we have, apart from an anti-Pfaffian relative that a number of people here like. I mean, I am open-minded whether it's Pfaffian or anti-Pfaffian, I'm happy with them. Whatever nature likes, it's fine with me. But so imagine now that instead of having two of these quasi-particles, two of these vortices, I'm going to have 4 of them. Let's say label 1, 2, 3, 4, they are coordinates. In this particular case, if I give you the coordinates, I fully specify the state. The state is uniquely determined. It turns out that here, if I want to specify the state, it's not enough to give the coordinates of the state. There are branch cuts in the wave function, if you want to use that terminology. And so there are 2 ways of specifying the state. So you can either run your cuts, if you wish, that way, or you can run them this way. So there are a number of possible degenerate states in this case, too. There are 2 linearly independent states which have the same coordinates. And the 2 states are equally good states, so you end up with a 2-dimensional space of states for fixed particle coordinates. And so now you have a state, let me call one state 1 and the other state 2. And let's say I begin with state particles in state 1, and now I try to do my braiding operation, the analog of that. Because a state is not uniquely determined, you are going to end up with a linear combination of these 2 states. So when you braid 2 of these particles, you end up with a linear combination of the 2 states that are degenerate. If I braid these other particles, I also end up with a linear combination, but it's a different one. So in other words, I need to specify some matrix to determine the state. And if I have a large number of these particles and I do different braidings, I will get different matrices. Matrices don't commute in general. That's where the term non-abelian comes from. Now, this, the fact that this state existed attracted the attention of a number of people, particularly Kitaev first, I think, and Michael Friedman, who's here, to propose the idea that you can use this quantity, these type of states, to make what is called a qubit, in other words, a topological state, a topologically protected state that could be used to make quantum computation. So notice that these things are, in principle, very non-local. These things can be very far from each other. How this thing actually works beyond this cartoon level are things which we don't understand at present time. But we understand, the questions at the moment are very basic, is can you find the states? Are these a good description of what is actually seen in the experiment? Remember, this, one of the virtues of this field is you actually have experiments you need to explain. Back in 98, with Chetan Nayak and Frank Wilczek and Alexis Selig, we proposed the generalization of this idea. And we found a rather remarkable result that we were so enthused that we didn't do anything with it. which we found is that the interference part of the pattern here measures a quantity. So here you're braiding these things. Their histories are being braided. Okay? And the, in topology, there is a set of topological invariants that essentially are related to knot theory that go under the name of the Jones polynomial. And there is a famous field theory called the Jones-Simons field theory, for which Ed Witten got the Fields Medal, for showing how that theory relates to the theory of the Jones polynomial in knot theory. So here is this material which has a lot of junk inside. And by doing these simple interference operations, you measure something which is just a Jones polynomial of that configuration. And we were so fascinated with that we didn't try to do a calculation for four particles. Because, well, the other reason was that we were told that no one will do the experiment, so why bother? Now, things have changed, and since the people here convinced Bill Gates to put some money, there is some more funding in the field, which was drying up for a while, and so now more experiments are being done. And so people are trying to gear towards doing these sort of interferometers, and the first step is to actually measure to find that the particle that you're having is actually the right particle. Now, there was a prediction from this theory that this particle had charge E over 4. It's a quarter of the electron charge. There is an experiment, there are two experiments now, one also from Heiblum's group doing something quite similar to what he did like 10 years ago. This was published in Nature last week, actually. And there is a paper that is still unpublished from Charlie Marcos at Harvard. It's not a noise experiment, it's a tunneling experiment. And they both detect the same charge one quarter. Within the experimental error, the consistency checks are different in these two different experiments. They are not the same experiment. So each experiment has its problems, but they both agree. And that's a good thing. Okay. Also, they get one third when they are supposed to get one third. They get one when they are supposed to get one. And so it's a good indication that this quarter charge particle is now seen. So the next step, of course, would be to construct an interferometer to get to the non-abelian statistics, essentially, to get to that. If you do this calculation for the five-hour state, and this was done by Adi Stern and Bert Halperin and a number of other people, Parzival, Wonderson, and Kirill Stengel, and others, you find that there is a remarkable even-odd effect. When there is an even number of quasi-particles, you get an answer. When there is an odd number, you get zero. And of course, something that is non-zero, it's easy to compare something which is non-zero to something which is zero, the two things which are just different. And so it's that, that's actually an interesting result, which we could have done 10 years ago, but we didn't. Okay. So let me close with some comments on entropy and how entropy enters in all of this. Maybe I'll skip the other quantum critical point given in time. So a number of people, particularly people who some, I'm not sure if Matthew is here in the audience, or Chetan, since they were involved in that, and Michael Levin with Wen, did calculations for these types of states of the entanglement entropy. So there were two papers in particular that refocused this field into the concept of entanglement. And so it's a paper by Kitaev and Prestil, and a paper by Levin and Wen, that where they show that if you have a topological phase such as the ones that we encounter in the quantum Hall effect, there are a number of other phases that some of us have worked on that for which these ideas also apply, and the entanglement entropy in that case, again, you have a big system and you're going to study only some subsystem of size L. So again, the big system is supposed to be macroscopic in size. There is now a term which is linear, because this is the L to the D minus 1, D is 2, so there will be a term. People call it the area term, although this is the perimeter, obviously, here. It has a non-universal coefficient. Okay, so this coefficient, let me call alpha, in general depends on the correlation length of the system, and only and is some number that is non-universal. There is a constant term to me. This is actually how this is usually presented, the terms of order one. And this constant term, at least for systems that have smooth boundaries, that's the only one you can have. If you have a lattice, then you can have corners, and there are also other one non-universal terms that you need to worry about. But for systems which are like the quantum Hall effect, that are in the continuum, you don't have corners or anything like that in general. So gamma turns out to be a universal quantity, and it's given by a peculiar quantity called the log of the effective quantum dimension D. So let me tell you just in a few words what that quantity is. So you take your particles, so for instance in the case of the Laughlin state here, has three possible states. The identity, namely the ground state, the one the state labeled by a quasi-particle charge 1/3, and then the one with charge 2/3. The quasi-particle charge 3/3 is called the electron. If it is an electron condensate, it doesn't count. So it turns out that this number D is the sum of these degeneracies, if you wish, or quantum dimensions of each one of the particles summed in quadratures. For the Laughlin state, this number is the log of the square root of the denominator, 3 in the case of the 1/3 state. Now for the...
Why is that minus and why is that not a order one?
Well, it's minus here, and this is a positive term that has a negative coefficient here.
In the entropy?
Yeah.
And how do you distinguish minus gamma?
Sorry, order one over n. It's order one over n. Okay? So this term is universal in the sense that if you change the shape of the region, nothing changes. Okay? So it doesn't know about the shape of the region, doesn't know about the geometry. If you had a quantum critical point in two dimensions, it might depend on the geometry, and in fact that's the other part of the calculation. That's where the shape of Schrödinger's cat will come in, and that's the part I will not discuss. It turns out in that case there is a possible logarithmic dependence on the size of the system that is very much reminiscent to a problem that in the studying the free energy of classical two-dimensional systems was formulated by Mark Katz as, can you hear the shape of the drum? And this, in a sense, since it's a similar calculation, but you're looking at entanglement entropy, we called it, can you hear the shape of Schrödinger's cat instead? But, so in a sense, the question is there a logarithmic term in the entropy? In the topological phases, there isn't one. But if you have a topological phase instead of a logarithmic term, you get this universal constant term, which is a property of the entire phase. So if you make changes, you know, change your Hamiltonian a little, change the short distance properties of the wave functions a little, the prefactor, the linear term will change. This non-universal term will change, but this term doesn't. Okay. So one of the questions that I think is of some interest is, are these things measurable in any way? Can this be detected by some experiment? So let me end with some speculation about that. There was a calculation.
Edward, could you explain the psi, which looks to be unintuitive?
Why is negative?
Yeah, it looks like it's something that measuring, as you said, the phi difference over the amount of tension.
Yes?
Do you think that was bigger?
Oh, for a bigger one.
It would be bigger and not smaller.
I think you could say that the charge has to be the same, the topological charge on the inside and the outside. So if you observe the region A inside, you learn accidentally what the charge of B is, so you've lost less information.
Yeah, so, okay, so the intuition that you have, which I think is correct, is that it applies to the entropy change. So if you take a big system and you split it in two, you want to know, and you observe only one part, then that entropy will go up, and it will go up by that amount, the log of square root of n, because in one system, so that's how it works out. So the entropy change is always positive in that sense. But if you calculate the entanglement entropy for a given system and you observe only one part, that's how it comes about here. That's different than projecting the state, the system, into a subset. So this is done with a given state without projection. So there is no collapse, if you wish, for the wave function. you still have information about these correlations in the rest of the system. So, but if you actually take the system, and this is actually the point I was going to make, so if you go and look at one of these constrictions, and you have some voltage, as a function of voltage, what happens, there are two fixed points. One is when this is open, the other is when this is closed. And you have a situation where the system is actually split in two. If you compute the change in the entropy that you get there, you get log of root 3, plus. And this is a result that was found by Findley, Nayak, and Fisher. Now, the question is, can this be detected in noise tunneling experiments? Until recently, I thought this wasn't possible. There is an interesting result. I'm not sure whether it's an analogy or a connection. That's what we are trying to figure out. It's a paper that was posted last week, I think, by Leonid, who's here, Levitov, and Israel Klitsch, where they do a simpler problem than this with free fermions, and they show that there is a connection between the entanglement entropy in a system where you have a constriction in which you open and close with like a shutter, if you wish, in a photographic camera, and the noise in the current, that you can actually measure the entanglement entropy in that context. So it's an interesting possibility, but this needs to be studied. This is a new result for a simple non-interacting case, whether this is actually a way to measure this topological entropy. You see, in a sense, the system is still non-local, but by taking a topological fluid and splitting it in two, you actually have access to non-local information. And so these point contacts actually have a lot of interesting information from this point of view. So let me stop here.